are listening to the Mythmaker Podcast Network.
I want to deal now for the next week or two with the problem of the psychological implications of mythology. What are the reasons for the continual recurrence of these myths and their fundamental importance to the development of society? If we think of the problem of the archetypal images continually recurring everywhere, we may ask whether in the human mind there are any inherited images. Does the human psyche hold within itself some systems of response to images that are automatic? We know that there are such response systems in the animal psychologies. There have been some very interesting studies of these. A wonderful little book is by Tinbergen, T-I-N-B-E-R-G-E-N, Tinbergen, A Study of Instinct. You'll be amazed at the precision of the responses of animals to quite specific stimuli. For example, little chickens just hatched from an egg, a little coop of these. If a hawk flies over the coop, the little chickens will scurry for shelter. But if a pigeon flies over, they will not do so. And the experimenters have made model hawks of wood and have drawn such models across this coop on a wire, and the little things run for shelter. But if the same model is drawn across backwards, they do not do so. Now this is what is called a key-lock relationship. A precise image elicits a response that is correct. Now you may ask yourself, you know, if we were talking about human psychology, spoke about these, all the Freudians would say, oh, this is mystical. There's nothing mystical about it at all. Who is responding? Is the little individual responding? Or is it the species somehow that is living in him? This is what Jung, in his psychology, calls archetypes. Images that elicit responses automatically from the species. Of course, this is the century of initials. So these response mechanisms are called innate response mechanisms, IRMs. Innate response mechanisms. In the central nervous system, there is an organization which responds to a certain sign stimulus. Sign stimulus A elicits a response. And the type that I have just described is called a stereotype. And this is called a closed system. I once saw in the movies a film of a turtle, a mother turtle, laying eggs just beyond the shore, the waterline, laying eggs in the sand. And in about 18 days, a multitude of tiny little turtles came up out of the sand and started directly for the water immediately. Not one of them turned the wrong direction. You could just see them scoop for the water. And meanwhile, the gulls saw them, and the gulls were diving down like dive bombers, picking off these little fellows as they were heading for the waves. Now, they didn't pause a minute when they saw these great big breakers coming in. They went right in, and then they swam. They knew exactly where to go, what to do. These are stereotype stimuli to which proper responses follow. Now, in contrast to the little chicken, when a little duck is hatched from an egg, it responds as to a parent to the first moving organism it sees. I had a friend who had the misfortune to be present when a duck was hatched from the egg, and this little duck followed her all around all the time. She was one duck. And the story of the hen that is shot when her chicken dives in the water and goes to swim is well known. Here, we have what is called an imprint. Instead of a stereotype, there is an imprinting. Now, the characteristic of the imprint is that it is established once and for all at a moment of readiness. In the course of the development of the animal psyche, if we may say this, the animal's nervous system, there are moments of readiness when the imprintings take place. And the characteristic of the imprint is that it is indelible. It can't be erased and a new imprint substituted. This kind of system is called open. It is open to imprint, but once the imprint is there, there it is. Now, with respect to the human psyche, I needn't go through the whole business, but the general consensus of opinion is that at least the majority of the human releasing mechanisms are of the open order. Consequently, if the imagery of mythology is constant throughout the world, there must be a constant pattern of imprints. Certain inevitable imprints are established on the psyche. These, together with certain possible closed or stereotype systems in the human psyche, must be taken into account for the force of mythological images. They are, and here's a term that I value greatly, they are energy-releasing signs. A mythology is an organization of energy-releasing signs. And if you get the idea that the signs like this works automatically, the brain doesn't have to say, what is it? It just happens. You'll realize how important it is to interpret and understand mythology as something working below the level of conscious decision. Below the level of conscious definition. The mind then may ask, well, why is it, and what is it, and give definitions and all this kind of thing. But the image works. Now what I want to do is consider this problem of the images, these images that are imprinted on the human psyche and actually function in mythology. And to do this, I'll make a few general remarks about the problems of the development of the human psyche everywhere. Just big general terms that seem to me to help greatly to an understanding of mythology and its problems. The first characteristic of the human being in its developmental aspect is that it has the longest infancy of any animal in the world. The human being is dependent, is in a situation of dependency, actual physical dependency, at least to the age of 12. And the physiological development does not reach maturity, does not reach fulfillment until in the early 20s. But in these early years of childhood, the response mechanisms are of dependency. Now that is important. The mother image, the father image, and the child assumes attitudes of dependency. However, at a certain time, we'll call this puberty, when the child has to cross this threshold into adulthood, all of the responses have to be changed. They must now be responses of responsibility. And in these terms, all a neurotic personality represents is a continuation of attitudes and responses of dependency into adulthood, which then have to be corrected consciously, so that the conscious mind, say to itself, after all, act your age, I know how old I am, I should be doing this. The conscious mind is continually correcting a trend in the unconscious, which is pulling the individual back. These fixations on parental, or rather infantile responses to images, are the sources of the great agony in our world today. In primitive societies and in the old archaic societies, rites of initiation had to do with bringing the individual over that threshold. And these rites were mythological ritual rites. That is to say, they had to do with transforming the response system to images. It had nothing to do with rational education. It had to do with changing the automatic response to an image. Now, the next important realization about the human being and its development is that it has the longest old age of any animal. And furthermore, it knows that death is coming to itself. This is the only animal that is aware of death as its own destiny. And as one begins to fail and move toward that door, there are resistance attitudes. And if the life energies are going to be carried onward courageously throughout the course of the life, the images again have to invite. The images that in childhood elicited attitudes of dependency, in adulthood responsibility, in old age have to elicit attitudes of self-giving, giving up the corporal character and identifying with something of permanence. Now, one might say that for young people, the fear is life, and the threat is life, and the tendency of retreat is back into mother's world. The noon of life involves a complete change of symbols. What was the threat is now what one would retreat to. One, the threat now is death, and one would hang on to life. Now this moment comes a little earlier than you think. I've heard a very instructive aphorism that gives me a sense of when it comes. At least this is valid for the normal Occidental male, let's say, or the American male today. Before this moment, the principal interests are wine, women, and song. And after that moment, Metrical, the same old gal, and sing along with Mitch. When that moment has come, you're ready for the abyss. Sing along with Mitch. Mitch. Now we have this to say. Universal to man, and no matter where, are the imprintings of childhood, which I shall be talking about in detail in a moment. Universal also is this problem here. There's a wonderful rapport, and it's a darling thing to see, of old age and little childhood together. These are the eternal people. In the midst are those oriented to the specific tasks of this particular society. Particularity comes here. The responsibilities in a primitive hunting society are very different from those in a society such as ours. The responsibilities in a peasant society are very different from those in a warrior community. So the specifics are associated with the middle period. And now comes something very interesting. These universal attitudes and images, which befit the experiences of childhood and old age, must also serve in a variety of ways for the various societies, hence the distinctions between mythology everywhere. The normal function of mythology in the social sphere, that is to say, in its establishment of people functioning as adults, is to establish what I call a system of sentiments on which the society may depend. It has to expect its individuals to act as an organism. It's only an ample, lavishly wealthy society such as ours that can tolerate deviance. The seriously living, seriously threatened early societies could not do that. Everyone was, as it were, an organ in an organism. And the person who didn't behave in terms of the responses expected was a sick organ and was no good and had to be liquidated. That was the old style, and in some places today, it's the new style. Now I'm going to come at a somewhat later moment to the problem of responsibility. For the present, I just want to leave these three statements. From dependency to responsibility in the period of the puberty rites. From responsibility to acquiescence in the grandiose experience of all mankind in the periods of senility. Here is wisdom. Here is capacity and competence. And here is hope and possibility. Now, in discussing these two great crises, I'm going to take two authorities as my model. The most thorough discussion of the problems of this transition seemed to me to be under the name of Freud in the psychoanalytic schools. Freud's principal concern is with neurotic deficiencies in this passage and the interpretation of the imagery of neurosis and psychosis at this stage. The best, I believe, discussion of the latter phase of our common experience is under the name of Jung. And so I want now, in a very systematic and abridged way, to present to you, at least my view, of the main themes of Freud and Jung in these contexts, trying to deal particularly with those aspects of their theory that relate to the problem of the imprint and the mythological utilization of the imprint. Now, just to move on rapidly to Freud, big, like that. The basic theme in Freud psychology is of the imprint as a kind of wish machine. The infant wants. It doesn't even have an ego yet. All it is a wish machine. Freud calls this dynamism the it. It is an it. In German, it's the ace. This wish comes against prohibitions. And the prohibitions are rendered by the parent. The parents express the prohibitions in terms of the moral values and customs of that particular society. So we have society. Here is this natural wish meeting with prohibitions that vary from one culture to another in terms of the social order, the social mores, the social value system, also in terms of the temperament of the parent. The parental image, then, is the vehicle through which thou shalt not comes. Now, Freud tells us that one of the important characteristics of the child's mentality is that it cannot endure a long tension of dissatisfaction. It has no patience. It requires something, and that must come. Otherwise, it's left, and there's this crying and all of this. A good parent distracts the child from something it mustn't have. If the parent doesn't, presently the child will distract itself. It can't bear going on wishing for something, wishing consciously, that it can't realize. So the wish, and now I'm just going to use Freudian terms without apology, the wish goes into the unconscious. All the word unconscious means is that you're not being conscious of it anymore. It's still there, but you're not thinking about it. And you're systematically not thinking about it. The wish goes into the unconscious, but with the the wish goes to prohibition. That's the secret nugget of the whole thing. The wish, a positive, takes down into the unconscious with it a negative factor. And this double pull, which is what is called ambivalence. Ambi is two, valence is pull, ambivalence. It's characteristic of all unconscious wishes. Now please note what has happened. A portion of the social value system has been introjected, has been taken into the unconscious. Introjection. Piece by piece, the social judgment is being incorporated in the psyche, always in relationship to the pertinent wish. This is like an electric charge, which now has to be discharged. This is energy. It has to be discharged. And it is discharged in a substitute activity, what is called a surrogate. But it is an unconscious surrogate. You think you are kicking the dog because the dog is bad. You're really kicking the dog because the boss gave you a punching around in the office this afternoon. The whole temperament of a person who finds the whole world terrible is the result of too much introjected negativism. This is called projection. Now Freud's theory is that when you find yourself fascinated by something, either with a positive or a negative fascination, there is an unconscious content under there. The I, your mind up here, looking at the object, thinks you like it for reason A, but it's really serving a surrogate function for you. As they say, I can tell you good reasons for doing it, but I can't tell you the real reason. I can give lots of explanations. These explanations are called rationalizations. Now, when the whole world of interest is built on surrogate reactions of that sort, everything has a plus-minus character. You're always in a buzz. Kind of general sense of nervousness, as though punishment were going to come at you. One of the great fields of surrogate experience, of course, is dreams. Dreams, says Freud, are wish fulfillments concealed under distracting and deceptive imagery. What about dreams that seem awful? What about nightmares? In the nightmare, what you are experiencing is the punishment for something that you are enjoying one level further down. So watch out for your nightmares. They give you a clue to what mother told you not to do. Now, are there any questions here? This is the ABC of the subject, and I will move on to another phase in a moment. It's not too difficult, yeah?
Will the knowledge of your explanation, rationalization, have any bearing on the mechanism of this situation?
What it does is make your deceptions more recondite, more difficult to follow. That's all. It doesn't do any good just to hear a lecture on something. If this were solved, there wouldn't be so many psychoanalysts. What Freud found was this, that by leading the person back through what he called free association, he could approach the explosion of this. What is it that gives you this dip? You see? Now, I had a dream last night. Well, what was the dream? Oh, I dreamt of a horse clattering down the street. Have you ever dreamt of that before? Well, come to me now and then. Yeah. Now, what does the horse make you think of? Then you think back to scenes and scenes and scenes. And you finally learn, you see, it's a It's the milk wagon horse. My mother was the milk wagon long ago. And the thing that I'll get back to mother and daddy from me. But this free association becomes more and more difficult to follow as you approach the crooks. Then you think, oh no, this is absurd, and your mind doesn't work. Until one day you realize, say, I'm paying this fellow $25 an hour for this, and this is beginning to pile up. I better break through. So the rationalization of the high fees of the is that without the high fee, nobody would have the spunk to push through and explode. Well, those are the boring ones. A true rational action is one that you do simply for rational reasons, versus figuring out how to carve a stake. Because you have a tendency to carve stakes in rather symbolic ways. But if you really analyze the darn thing and go at it, some people find they can't cut stakes. They cut their fingers and get it all over the floor and anything like that. That's because the stake has a lot of symbolic value. And the way to learn to carve a stake for that person is to learn what daddy did to him back there.
What is the term that you apply to the second process when the prohibition is such a big paramount?
Introjection. You introject, you pull into yourself the social taboo. The summation of interjections is what is called conscience. Conscience, according to Freud, is not innate. It is a socially conditioned structure, different in various people according to the social environment. This has nothing to do with physical race at all. It has to do with social environment entirely. This is introjected and built in so that it becomes nature.
That's sublimation.
Sublimation is finding surrogates that the society will accept. Instead of tearing up daddy, you get a job tearing up papers. And this becomes something very interesting, but the society can use that. It turns you into a filing clerk or something of that sort. And this is a sublimation, you see? A sublimation is a socially acceptable surrogate.
When one can go back to his early beginnings, he was already willing to go back. Sometimes even before the great psychologists, they refuse, the patient refuses to go way back for that which hurts so much. When he is ready to go way back and he recalls, does the
help? Yeah, then that thing explodes and he's loose. It's called the ab reaction. All the emotions are now available. Yeah.
Can you say something about the distinction between sublimation and inhibition?
Well, I suppose an inhibition is the inhibition without an adequate sublimation, where the person has not found an adequate sublimation. Now what happens is, if you find surrogates that are socially acceptable, there's almost no problem. I mean, this is what mythology is for, to give everybody socially acceptable surrogates. That's a mythology, and the initiation is the rendering of these imprints available to the individual as stimuli to link him to the society. But if your surrogates are different from those of other people, an isolation comes in, and a sense of alienation from the society, and that only aggravates the terror aspect of the thing, because one is always expecting punishment. As Schopenhauer says, to go back to my little metrical thing, before that date, when there's a knock on the door, you think, here it is, and after that date, you think, here it is. here it comes. Well, I think I'll move to the next phase of my little schedule here. This leads to a view of the psyche, you might say, as a two-story house, with the unconscious down here, and you living up here. If I ask you what you're doing this time, November 5th, say 15 years ago, this time of evening, November 5th, 15 years ago, you might have trouble recollecting. But if you have a diary or notepad somewhere, you might be able to conjure up, you probably would be able to conjure up the entire evening and remember the whole thing. That is something that is not in your consciousness, but is available to consciousness. Freud calls this the preconscious. Consciousness is like a little beam of light flickering on and shining on just what is in your conscious mind right now. But we can turn it on to many, many scenes in the past in our memories. However, if I ask you about November 5th, what's the time? 9:30, the year you were born, couldn't remember it at all. That is down absolutely in the unconscious. You can never find that. So we have consciousness, the light being flickered around, preconscious and unconscious. Now if that light doesn't begin to work, it begins to fail a little bit. You're forgetting more than you used to. Or certain things you can't find yourself thinking about at all. You can't put your mind in a certain direction. You may then fool around with the light to try to get that battery going. But the battery isn't in the light. The machine's down here. The wire goes down here. That part calls the id. That's the wish system. And you can't fix it. You've got to send a man down. The psychoanalyst. And he may know about just about as much as the man from the plumber knows when he goes down into your basement. It's not a good idea to send folks down unless you're pretty sure. Now this id, this wish machine, doesn't know the date. Little babies born today have essentially the same organism as little babies born 50,000 years ago in the Aurignacian cave. Their wish system is that of Mother Nature. Up here we have ego, the little thing that can say I in us. What do they call in Sanskrit? Ahankara, the thing that makes the noise I. And ego can look out the window, and ego can see, oh yes, this is 1963, and I'm in the USA, and there are great big buildings all around, and there's no fishing. it can find all this out. Freud calls the ego, and this is a very important term, and it's going to become more and more important as we try to distinguish Occident from Orient. Freud calls the ego the reality function. It is that factor in the psyche which is concerned to know what is going on now and who and where I am in the reality. And for Freud, reality is a very simple word. Simply means the empirical facts round about. No deep metaphysical problems at all. When he speaks of reality function, he means that part of the mind which can put us in touch with our environment and our own relationship to it. It down here is the pleasure principle or pleasure function. All it knows is, please me, please me, please me. But as I've already said, there is something that is put down there by the society and says, no, no. Freud calls this the superego. Ego says, I want. Superego says, thou shalt. Reality function says, oh, but look, things are different now. And they are. Now, in the nursery, all we have are I want and thou shalt, because the little thing doesn't know anything yet. In traditional societies, now this is a very important theme, in archaic societies and throughout the Orient and in primitive societies, the individual must identify himself in adulthood with the thou shalt system. He must not question it. This is the system of sentiments that the society is trying to make him follow without question. In the, thank God, Greece-based, derived from Greece, system of the West, the idea is an individual who will make his own judgments here and now in terms of values that he personally honors, and they may differ from the values of the society. Individual responsibility and accepting the responsibility of individual judgment as against the good soldier who does as he is told, no matter what it is, in terms of the society's thou shalt. Now, this is a very important problem, morally and every other way. This, I'm going to, I think, be able to show in the course of the next weeks, this is the typical attitude of the West, of the European West. And as far as the history of the world goes, it's the only part of the world where the individual judgment and the development of individuals capable of responsible judgment and decision has been honored. Other parts of the world continually say, erase ego, egolessness. This is the great religious theme almost everywhere. Your intellectual pride, who are you to be asking these questions? So, do what you're told and get back in the nursery. There's a principle of stasis here, and it turns up in many, many ways. We'll come more to more of this later. In an superego, in the traditional society, what you want to do is cancel it, cancel the wish system, and sublimated entirely to superego themes. Now we move on to, I'm going to come back to this when we come to the discussion of Oriental cultures in a few weeks. Now I want to bring up just one more little chart. Stimulus. I'm hungry and I see an apple. Eat the apple, you're fine. That's a very healthy thing to do. This, Freud calls the progressive path of the energy. The energy just flows right through and you're a good, healthy animal. Progressive path. Progression. You have memories, conscious memories. Conscious memories. And you think, well, last time I had an apple, there was a worm in it. And I had half the worm already swallowed. I don't think I want that again, and let me see, this is the same kind of apple. Very sensible thought. And you decide, no, I won't eat the apple, and you know why you're not eating the apple, and that's a rational decision and judgment. On the other hand, you have unconscious memories also. You know, apples, that's food. And you know the trouble you have getting your children to eat food. Food has a very close association with mother and attitudes toward mother. And so there are unconscious memories that you're not aware of, and you don't know why it is, you always get kind of jittery when you reach for an apple. Now it can be that there are more and more and more things that you get jittery about when you reach for them, in which case the energy is not flowing through. You're always stopping. You're being stopped by an unconscious order of recollections, which has no value in this context. A stream that is blocked backs up. Put a little dam, a beaver dam, in a small stream, and pretty soon the water's flooding the whole countryside back there. Land that should be dry is now wet. Trees that should be standing dry are saturated. So also, when the energies flow back, this is called the regression, regressive path, they activate memories that should have been left unactivated. The individual becomes fixated in his own fantasies. And one lives by fantasy. One can't eat an apple because there is some kind of fantasy attached to it. A life of this kind breaks off from reality altogether and can follow what is called a psychosis. where the individual has lost touch with reality, schizoid split, so that reality means nothing. A person is living in a fantasy world that has no relationship. What are the fantasies? What are the imprints down there that are holding them? And now I'm just going to move to the next and final phase of this. The imprints that are established in infancy, that are the fixating powers in the unconscious to which the individual is bound. Now this is a rather wild story. We've all been through it. Freud divides the stages of early childhood development into three great stages. And I'm going to present them simply in terms of the imagery that has pertinence to our subject. There are many other details in here, but I'm just going to cut it right down to this. The first is that of infancy, the little child between the ages of birth and up to about 5 or 6. The second he calls latency, and I'll come to the explanation of this term, latency, and they say between 5 and 6 and 11 and 12, this period of childhood. And then, of course, the puberty as the end of this particular phase of the story, on to greater things. I'm going to discuss the infancy in terms of 4 points that have great importance for our subject. The first is that of birth itself, what the psychologists call a birth trauma. From darkness to light, there are images that remain imprinted. Darkness associated with the peace and, as it were, unconsciousness of the child in the womb. Light associated with self-sustaining existence in a world of air, where the child has to breathe, do his own breathing, do his own digesting, and is in an atmosphere that may not be just the right temperature for him. Furthermore, at this moment of birth, there is a shock and stagnation of poison in the blood and so forth before the little thing begins to breathe. The doctor has to give it a hit and make it cry and start it going. And then, sure, it's alive now out in the world. It's a little animal instead of a little plant taking care of itself. These images now play into all of our dreams and into our mythologies. The plant world as something of peace and repose and harmonious vitality. The animal world as in the sphere of activity and battle and quest and all of this. One of the regressive tendencies is back to the womb. One wishes to go back to the realm of peace, and the image of womb bliss, so to say, remains as an image of in the mythology. Also sleep and death, and back to the birthplace again. The tomb itself later on becomes the womb of rebirth. And that formula is very important in mythological images. One must die to be born again. The birth trauma then, and the shock associated with it, and the sense of life as representing progression and development of consciousness and all of that, and darkness as the return to the vegetal existence. The next great phase is that, of course, of the infant in the mother's arms, and mother becomes the great image here. A mother has two aspects. There is, for the child, the good mother and the bad mother. The good mother is mother present. So, let's say the Madonna image. Next best to the womb is mother's arms. And it's amazing how in the mythologies of paradise, the image of inexhaustible food plays a great, great role. Freud calls this the oral phase of the psyche. The food is the main source of satisfaction. But the child, no matter how attentive the mother may be, can't always have its wishes fulfilled immediately. And mother absent is mother intentionally absent. The child cannot bear a long tension. It becomes frightened, it becomes angry, and it becomes violent in its thoughts. As the psychologists say, the child wants to tear good body substance from the mother. But it is immediately threatened by what is called the talion, the fear of retaliation in kind, that mother will tear good body substance from baby and eat it up. And so here comes the image of the cannibal ogress, which besets children, the ogress. Think, for instance, of Hansel and Gretel. They go out into the forest of mystery at night, and there's a witch there who likes to eat little children. And the witch lives in a candy house. The candy house is, of course, mother's body, and the witch is, of course, mother. She has that candy house only to attract children to her so that she can eat them. Now, I had a friend who was undergoing psychoanalysis, but also was undergoing the strain of being a young father. And he came to visit me one day with his son. And his son was a tiny little boy. And to keep the child quiet while his father and I were talking, Mrs. Campbell gave him a couple of little Japanese dolls that we had just brought from Japan, and the child took these, put them under a little low table, and sat quietly watching the doll. And half hour talk or so, and when we were ready and the father was about to go, the child got up and gave the dolls back, and my wife said, well, you know, that's a very good little boy, you sat very quietly there. And he just looked like this and said, I cook people. I just broke that.
I didn't hear it.
Oh, you couldn't hear it. The child says, I cook people. And the father, who was undergoing analysis, knew who the couple was that was being cooked. Now, I want to enlarge this image of mother. This is nature. Mother is the child's first personification of the powers of nature. Nature does bring us forth, does nourish us, and does eat us back. And so, in the great mother mythologies, where the mother goddess is a dominant figure, she is shown in both aspects, often simultaneously. For example, the great Indian Hindu goddess Kali. The word Kali means simply time. It is the feminine form of the word time. Kali, K-A-L-I, which brings forth and eats back all things, just as mother does. Kali is shown with one hand in this posture, which means, do not be afraid. Another hand in this posture, called the boon-bestowing posture, often holding a little a bowl of rice. This is the bestowing side of mother. This hand holds a sword, and this a head that she has just cut off. And her kilt is made of arms and legs, and her necklace is of 72 skulls. And her tongue is out to her chin to lick up the blood of her own children. And in the cult of the goddess, wherever it exists, there is an infinitude of sacrifice of blood, animal and human, poured into channels that carry the blood back to her again. So that she is, the sow that eats her farrow. She springs forth and eats back, and that is what nature does. And to think of nature without thinking of the two sides of it is to misconceive it. Now there comes a moment in the child's life, and it's around the age of four, where a realization of the implications of the boy-girl difference comes along. This is a very important moment. At that moment, the boy becomes a boy and the girl a girl. Before that, it had been mother and babe. And the immediate relationship had nothing to do with sex. It had to do with babe and mother. But when one child realizes it's a girl and the other it's a boy, new relationships to the mother and to the father come along, and here is where daddy comes in. Daddy, number three on the list. Daddy becomes, for the boy, the rival for mother. The boy's proper relationship is to the woman. The daddy becomes, for the girl, her first sweetheart. Meanwhile, daddy is, for the boy, the model for the boy's future life, his future manhood. Father represents the principle of relationship to society and adulthood. He is the boy's pedagogue into his work. Or, if the boy finds him repulsive or incompetent in his work and always in anguish or something, the boy acquires a fear for the life task of father and may go into revolt against him. But there's no question about it, in the traditional society, the father was the pedagogue to society. And the father image does represent the social image and the mother, the nature image. And so we find in societies such as the Hebrew society, where the social law, the law of this society, is interpreted as God's law, a great accent and emphasis on the male God and no goddesses. But in societies where the cosmic law, the natural law, is regarded as the law that man should follow, not the local social law, but the ever-present, ubiquitous natural order, then mother goddesses play a very big role. And one of the most interesting things in mythology is to see this conflict between what might be called father systems and mother systems, and then interactions between these. This leads us to Freud's great image, the Oedipus complex. Oedipus kills his father by mistake, oh yeah, and married his mother by mistake. Freud says that's what every little boy wants to do. Father is the first enemy, and all enemies are father surrogates. So a fine sublimation of wanting to hit your father is to want to hit the man on the other side of the battle line. When one goes hunting, there is a crisis that's known as buck fever. When that great moose comes into view, the gun begins to go like this. Who's afraid of a moose? But that's no moose. The Oedipus complex, then, is the kind of summation of this whole thing that Freud gives. The desire of the boy, the little hero here, for the great big goddess, and between is the great big daddy with the club. Now, says Freud, if a little boy registers this, if he becomes aware of the fact that there is a desire for his mother which makes him want to eliminate father, then he may say, oh no. Deeply down, he may say, oh no, I'm my father. Women, I hate women. Oh, that this too solid flesh would melt. This Freud calls the Hamlet complex. The excessive submission to the father image and utter rejection of the mother. And there's something of the Hamlet in these patriarchal society patterns, where the goddess nature is out. She can go drown herself. Every man is Oedipus or Hamlet or both. Most of us, I'm afraid, are both. The woman, on the other hand, is in rivalry with mother for father's hand, and so Electra. Well, that's the way Freud works that out. Now, he says, if you want to know about sublimation and surrogation, the reason we like the Oedipus play is because it tells us this story. But we rationalize it by saying, oh, but it's so well constructed, and think of those characters, how well they're rendered, and the drama of this thing. That's what the literary man talks about. The psychoanalyst says, now we have two more phases and two more minutes. I'll pick this up next week. I just want to move ahead so that we know where we're going to be next week. This period of latency is that of little boy and girlhood and ego testing. The kid is out among other kids testing himself. Or the little girl has a dollhouse and all the little dolls are her family and she's being a little mother now. Danny, of course, is the secret all-father of this whole mansion. You have ego testing. And this is the period of the Peck series on the boys' campus. I had the misfortune of teaching boys' prep school for 1 year. And the vision of ubiquitous torment going on. You turn around and there'll be, oh, somebody with somebody else's head in the puddle. some pretty people learn to be, as they say later, born leaders. I'm just born followers. Not born at all. Suddenly it comes here. We'll have a little more to say about that next week. And finally, the song of love begins to dawn. And it's been latent in here. The erotic principle comes back. And its danger is that there'll be too much echo of mother and father and consequent ambivalences in relationship to members of one's own generation. Well, with that, let's have fun with you.
Pathways with Joseph Campbell is a production of the Joseph Campbell Foundation and the Mythmaker Podcast Network. It is produced by Tyler Lapkin. Executive producer, John Booker. Editing and audio services provided by Tristan Batt. All music exclusively provided by APM Music. For more podcasts and information about Joseph Campbell, please visit jcf.org.